Hello, and welcome to the Messy Truth About Leading People podcast. As always, I am Megan, joined by Nikki and Gavin. Hi, Nikki and Gavin.
Hi, guys.
Hey, hi, Megan, Nikki.
Hello. And so this week we are excited for another in our new series of Everyday Leaders Conversations. And on this rainy Friday afternoon, we have a former colleague of both Gavin and myself, Josh Allen, on the pod to share a bit about his journey with us. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, before we sort of get into your journey and your story, can you just introduce yourself for our fans and listeners?
Yeah, so my name's Josh Allen. I am born and raised in the Boston area, and my journey from a career standpoint has largely been with high growth technology companies, and it wasn't intentional, but I've really worked for Boston based high growth technology companies. So I spent 10 years of my career at LogMeIn, where I saw a company go from being a $3 million startup to a publicly traded company that was selling in a bunch of international markets and became kind of matrixed and complex over time until it merged with Citrix Online and became a very big company, which at point I left and went to another high growth technology company called CarGurus, where Megan and I worked together. And, you know, we went from 120 million to 440 million in about 8 or 9 quarters. So it was a really fast growth story, took the company public, went to Drift, another Boston-based high growth company, where it was kind of a collection of ex-LogMeIn and ex-HubSpot leadership coming together to build a company. We had a strong go-to-market motion there and built the company to a point where it sold to Vista Equity for $1.2 billion in 2021. And then I worked at a couple of smaller companies that were trying to build themselves up in Owl Labs and Tive, where it was really trying to see if we could kind of like recreate that early success and sort of building something to scale. So I feel like I've seen a wide range of businesses from the earliest days, the earliest types of kind of messy startup stuff, through that point of scaling and becoming a well-known global brand and publicly traded company, and kind of everything in between. And all of my work has been on the sales and go-to-market side. So really focused on getting products into the hands of customers and making sure that they're getting the value out of them that they expected to.
Awesome. Thank you for that. You've touched so many different companies and human beings. Certainly I recall from times working with you, and even from, you know, hearing from people that you've worked with outside of our times working together. And I think one of the things that's always struck me about you as a leader is what we talk about in this podcast is your deep self-awareness and your hunger, it seems, for growth and development and just improving yourself as a human and as a leader. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, outside of that career journey, a little bit about your life journey and, you know, in particular, some of the moments that have shaped you into the leader that you are today?
Yeah, I mentioned I grew up in the Boston area. So I grew up in a town called Saugus, which is about 10 miles north of Boston. It's a, you know, it's largely a working class town. And my dad was a commercial lobster fisherman full time. And I'm actually the first in 4 generations of my family on that side to not be running a lobster boat for the first time. So I think being raised in that type of environment where, you know, you're 10 years old and going on the back of the boat in the summer and working and banding lobsters and sort of learning what hard work looks like and feels like and smells like and sounds like. And from a very young age, knowing that I saw how hard my dad worked and that type of physical labor and like what it does to you over time. And if you throw out your back and you can't go fishing, you don't make money. And it was like kind of seeing that, I think sort of it created this foundation of, okay, like I know what hard work is and I can do that. I also don't want to do this thing that he's doing because There wasn't a ton of money in it, and I felt like I had a chance to sort of, I had advantages that he didn't have and that my mother didn't necessarily have. And so they sort of supported me and my sister of like just being able to like take that step forward. And I think like if I look back on sort of my career journey, a lot of it ties to that. There's a reason I keep a picture of my dad's lobster boat wherever I go, because it's sort of the reminder of a bad day in the office still beats a good day on the boat. Like there's a real thing associated with that for me. And so it sort of has, as I think, helped propel this growth mindset that I've settled into of truly wanting to get better. And it's not just work. It's not just getting better as a leader. It's working on myself physically. I think mentally trying to become more grateful for the things that you do have. Gratitude has always been a struggle for me, like actually being happy with what you have as opposed to thinking about like what's next and where am I going. So being able to stop and sort of pause and be in the moment. But it's definitely, it's an intrinsic thing, like genuinely wanting to improve and wanting to help others improve. So I don't know exactly where that came from, but it's very sort of deeply entrenched in how I operate.
How do you now, Josh, pause and be grateful and sort of be in the now, as opposed to kind of rushing forward? Because I think a lot of us, a lot of people we know, a lot of friends, and I myself, do that too much, I think. So, kind of being thoughtful about what I have now rather than something I'm aiming for, I think is quite an interesting thought to just explore a bit. Do you have any, yeah, I mean, what's your way of thinking about
So I literally have a post-it note on
that?
my desk that says gratitude. I had this conversation with a friend of mine from high school and college, and she gave me this gift. It's hard to see, but it says grateful on it. Just like it's like genuinely actually having physical reminders in front of me wherever I'm working and what I'm doing, so that when you're in that moment where you roll your eyes or you're frustrated or like you just kind of glance over and it's like, remember. This little itty bitty problem that you're dealing with right now that's kind of get you all wound up is not that big of a deal. So it's actually having those reminders. And I think being a parent and having I have two teenage daughters, one's 13, one's 15, and trying to like coach them through that as they go through those situations of kind of getting all worked up and getting worked up over small things like the Wi-Fi is down or my phone battery's dead, like that stuff, which we can laugh at as adults, but you see adults do it too, or they get all wound up over this stuff. So it is those reminders though. Like I've actually realized that I needed that physical reminder in front of me on a regular basis to help sort of when you get those stress spikes, it helps just kind of bring you back to level and normalizes it. That's worked for me.
Cool. Makes sense.
Can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned coaching your daughters, which I love. I remember, I think you had a post recently about coaching your daughter's hockey team. So thumbs up for you for having girl hockey players. When you think about Gavin now also has a girl hockey player, thanks in part to her fun aunt who lives next door, i.e. me. So we all have some girl hockey players in the pod. It just got me thinking about the way that you lead teams and the way that you think about coaching and development, both of individuals and more broadly teams, and also just living by example in that. Can you talk a little bit about how your journey has just informed how you think about that growth mindset in the workplace and on the teams you lead?
I was and still am, like I've always been obsessed with sports, like and it's everything. My wife thinks I have a sickness. Like it's like I'll watch everything from hockey to golf to darts, cornhole, like whatever's on lacrosse, whatever's on TV. Like if there's a competition, I'm interested because I'm so curious about people who perform at a very high level for a sustained period of time. So being able to see like ultra marathoners, like these people who do really spectacular things physically, because so much of it is in the mind, and sort of like being able to tap into like what are the things that they continue to do. So when I think about like my daughter. So I've coached my daughter's lacrosse team. I've coached her hockey team. It's you realize that for kids to genuinely improve, and this is overall for people too, but I'm kind of talking about it in the context of kids, for them to genuinely improve, it has to be bite-sized pieces of feedback that you're giving. You can't explain what is like if in lacrosse, if you're constantly missing the net with your shot because you're dropping your stick down to the side, you're not going to correct how they're put where they're putting their feet and how they're moving their shoulders and where their elbows are. You just have to like give them one cue. Just like come over the top and wherever your stick ends, wherever it's pointing, that's where the ball is going to go. And you just stick with that one little simple thing and let them use it and let them put it into action and let them feel the difference of it so that they can actually start to make the change. And then naturally they'll go back to what feels best for them and you have to kind of correct it. But over time, they do it the right way. And then you work on the other things. And so it's the same thing like in sales coaching, whether it's coaching an individual contributor in a deal or coaching a sales manager on how to handle a difficult conversation. You can't dissect the whole swing. You have to actually look at them and say, just work on this one piece right now. Focus on this piece that you have struggled with. Let's say they struggle with having a difficult conversation. It's like, okay, before that meeting, show up with the objective data set that you want to review and talk through, and just stick to the facts. Like you don't have to pull in all of these other things. You don't have to use filler words. You don't just stick to the facts and talk to them about what's happening. And then ask for feedback on why they think it's happening and initiate the conversation that way. You just want to give them the cues that they can actually put into action so that when they put it into action, they can see the feedback in real time. Like they're actually seeing the difference in that conversation versus the one they would have had before. And that's I think the best leaders I've had, like I just try to emulate what they've done for me. And the best ones I've worked with are the ones who can just like, we're going to sit on this one thing right now until it becomes part of your natural progression and your natural repertoire and how you're using it. And when you string a bunch of those together over a long period of time, you change and you get better at whatever you're doing and whatever you're trying to do. So that's how I've tried to be. And it's also because it's really hard to like blanket train a group. You have to be able to, like, at an individual level, what does this person need to work on the most? What's going to have the biggest impact on their day-to-day, their role, whatever they're focused on? And you go kind of person by person. That's how you have to treat it.
So I love everything that you've been talking about. Okay. And I don't have hockey players, but I do have a lobster person in my family who I might have to talk to you about so that he can actually see the reality of what it's like to work on a lobster boat with. So I wonder if I could expand the context of what you're saying, okay? Because you've worked with a lot of startups, and a lot of our listeners and a lot of people that we coach are really interested in that messiness of startup situation. Building on what you just said, Josh, about, it's individuals and they come to with default positions and you have to focus on just the one thing, which I think is brilliant. But as we know, startups are a group of high functioning, highly passionate, super intense people who want to conquer whatever that thing is, right? And they're usually coming from very distinctively different disciplines and perspectives. So that's a really interesting team situation. And given what you're just saying about focus on one thing, your love of teams and getting them to become high performers as collectively. What guidance would you offer to our listeners about that unique situation?
Well, first is it's not unique. It's everywhere. Like if you look at anyone who has raised venture funding, chances are 90% of them kind of fall in that bucket. Like and it's because I think what makes a founder great is they have suspended disbelief. Like they go into it suspending disbelief with the thought that I can do something better or faster or cheaper or something that has never been done before. And I'm going to start a company, and we're going to sort of like create this evangelical event that's built around this brand, that's built around this product or offering that we have. So to be wired that way means you have to think that you are above where everyone else is thinking, and that your thinking is different, and that you are building something differently. So when you put yourself into the shoes of a founder, you understand that they, like, to be successful, they have to be wired that way, which is also why so few of them, not all of them, but so few of them go on to be great operators and great leaders of people. Because if you're wired that way, it's really hard to be a great leader of a team where you can stand in front of them and think, all right, this person, they don't think like I do. They think differently. And I can empathize deeply enough to be able to get into what's not working for them, or what is working for them, or where they need to be coached. Most founders don't have the time for that. Like, they just, they like in their own minds, it's not an actual time thing. It's in their own minds. They don't have the time to go and do that. They also don't have the skill set, and they're not intrinsically wired to want to do that. So I think in those, that's why the best founders I've ever worked with build out incredible leadership teams, because they know that they can't do that. And they have to bring in those people that can almost serve as a buffer to them, but bringing those people that can build out the functional teams that they need to, and start to introduce the required specialization to build a company. Like, you need people who are great at a small number of things as you're building a company. Founders tend to be really good at a wide variety of things. Like, they'll build the first financial model, they'll code and build the product itself, they'll do some of the first branding and have input on the logo and what colors they're going to, like, all everything. They do everything. And that doesn't necessarily, they're kind of this big Swiss Army knife when you need a steak knife to be able to build your sales organization and make sure it's doing what it's functionally supposed to do, or every other organization. So I think my advice to those people that are kind of in that world is really just make, like, if you're a founder, if you're building a business, surround yourself with people externally who can kind of show you what you're missing, show you where your weak spots are. And a lot of investors are good at that, especially ones that have operated before. I know there's a lot of folks in VC that haven't necessarily operated before, but there are some really good ones who have. They come from that world and can give real experience as opposed to learned or read experience. And that's a big difference. But surround yourself with people, and then actually listen to them. Don't let it go in one ear and out the other. Like, listen and process and action, and take those steps to surround yourself with great people, because that's how you're going to build a great company. There's an old saying that I forget where this came from. I want to say it was Marc Andreessen or Ben Horowitz, one of the two, where they asked a question in the boardroom: do you want to be right or do you want to be rich? To the founders, because you can only have one. You can't have both. You can only have one. And if you want to be right, those are the founders that tend to hold on to everything and are very directive in their approach, and like push everything down, make decisions, clog all of the decisions, and make it really difficult to thrive. And then there are the founders who are like, yeah, no, you know, I want to build a big company. And I know in order to do that, I need to hire people who can run these functions independently and not need my input on everything.
That makes me think, Josh, could we just flip that around? So how do you personally deal with founders then, knowing all this? How do you get the best out of yourself, the best out of the founder, the best out of your sales go-to-market team, knowing that, you know, this is the environment you're in? Are there any kind of ways of approaching the situation of working with a founder that you think have been particularly helpful or particularly effective?
Well, I almost hate to paint with a broad brush across all founders, because I have worked with, like, Michael Simon, for example, at LogMeIn, is the most incredible founder I've ever worked with, because he was such a great operator and leader of people, in addition to being able to do all the hard things early on to start. I think he's on his third company now that he has started. LogMeIn was incredibly successful and built a really nice culture within the company too. So it was a place that people went and worked for a really long period of time, Mike is extremely rare. Like there are just not a lot of founders who fit that, especially now when we've seen, you know, really from like call it 2015, 2016 up until last year when things started to kind of fall apart. Like it's like now we're post the zero interest rate world. But there was a period where money was essentially free. And if you had an idea, you could raise capital. Similar to like when the bubble burst back in the early 2000s, it was kind of the same concept, was you could raise capital on a concept and then kind of go and build the company. And so I think there were a lot of founders who thought because they raised a bunch of money that they were right and that they were doing it the right way. They were building a company the right way. When in reality, they didn't have kind of the fundamentals of the business underneath it to support building what they were trying to build. So when you're picking a company as a functional leader, like in my case, as a go-to-market leader, I think when you're selecting that company, you have to be very careful about making sure you're teaming up with a founder, because there's a lot of founders will say in the interview process and in the process of courting you to come join their company, I want somebody who's going to come in. I'm going to give you the whole go-to-market. You're going to run it. Like, you know, we'll meet one-on-one, but just like, if you need my help, I'm going to be there to help. And then you get in and you realize, no, they're still trying to dictate like what your SDR team is built out like, and how they're feeding and the messaging that they're using for their outbound contacts to customers. And it's like, okay, this, like, you still want to have your talons in what's happening everywhere in the organization. You're not actually truly ready to move out of it and hand it off. And so some founders can adjust, they can be coached out of it. Others can't. And the ones who can't end up building smaller companies, because you can't build a large, long-term, high-scale company if you don't give your Legos away to the other people who are coming into the business. So it's hard. Like I've been duped on it. I joined a company where I was sort of told that on the way in, and it had all kind of the right pitch, the right positioning. And then you get in and you realize, no, like they can't let go. They have to hold on to everything and stay kind of stuck in. And so I made the decision to leave because it wasn't an environment that I knew my team could be successful in. And it's like, if I can't make my team successful because we're adding friction to every single micro decision that's being made, not worth it.
Can I push on that one just a little bit, Josh? Because we all are, we coach a lot of folks who are in an environment with a boss who has their hands tied. And when they're reflecting on what are my values, how can I thrive, what's best for me, and they grapple with the decision about staying and seeing what else they can do to improve the situation or making the decision to leave. And again, making the decision to leave your role has a lot of risk involved for lots mm-hmm. of people. They need a job, but the cost benefit to like your well-being at some point becomes critical. Can you say a little bit about like how you talk to yourself about leaving?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the there is a, and I think a lot, I know a lot of people have felt it because I've had a lot of these conversations in the last, really since the middle of 2022, I think is when we started to feel it. And then a lot of layoffs happened toward the end of 2022 and they only exacerbated throughout all of 2023. It's this almost like purgatory feeling where you're like stuck in the middle. It's the company's not bad and you weren't part of the layoff, so they still felt that you were a valuable contributor to the business, but the company is also not able to invest the same way they were. Maybe they cut out enablement and training, maybe they cut out what they were spending on marketing to drive pipeline, maybe you don't have that club trip or kickoff anymore because they're not willing to pay for the expenses of doing it. So there's sort of this like mid layer that a lot of people are sitting in right now where they're trying to decide like, yes, I have the security of a job. The company is sort of doing okay, I think, but I'm not, it's not what I thought it was going to be, and it's not giving me what I thought it was going to give me, right? That's the first thing everybody asks is what's in it for me whenever there's a change. I think my advice, and this is something that when I was early days at LogMeIn, I worked for our SVP of sales. His name was Kevin Harrison. We were going through a really growth. Like when you're going through that growth, like we were going through at LogMeIn, change is happening constantly all around you. And when you're going through it for the first time, it's very uncomfortable and it feels unnatural. It doesn't feel normal. He would always say to us, like, look, if you're trying to figure out whether to stay or go do something else, here are the three things that you should care about. It's earn, learn, and have fun. Are you earning the type of money you would expect to earn for the job that you're doing and the role that you're in and the experience you have? Are you learning something new and growing and actually getting better individually? Like, are you learning tools that you're going to be able to take with you and use in the future? And are you having fun? Like, do you actually like the people you work with? Do you like the office that you're in? Do you like the environment that you're in? Do you like the product that you sell and the people you sell it to? Like, do you enjoy that part of it? And he used to say, like, if you're 3 for 3, you're perfect. You're in a great spot. If you're 2 out of 3, you got to figure out how to fix that third one, but you can spend the time to work on it because 2 of them are still pretty good. If you're 1 out of 3, there's something off and it probably does make sense to start considering something else. And if you're 0 for 3, then you stayed too long. And so I think just like using that mental model, that very simple mental model, and sort of doing a self check on where am I across that, has always been helpful for me. And then I think what's changed as I've gotten older and have been in more leadership positions is now I'm much more comfortable having that direct conversation with, in my case, it's usually the CEO of like, look, here's where I'm at. This is how I'm thinking about the business. This is what I see for positives. And this is where we're struggling. And just having a direct conversation so you know where each other is in the process. And it gets harder to do when you're 24, 25 years old, it's your first technology job, and you don't know if this is normal of how to have that conversation. But I would encourage everybody to make sure that they're having those direct, if difficult, conversations, because you can't change anything if you don't know where you are and where the other person is.
That's great. Thank you.
I just have one more thought, Josh, which is about you, you as a functional leader. Are there any, is there like one idea, one guide, tip, one recommendation you have for folks in similar roles to that, whether it's go to market or any other functional leader, in how to build an effective team, how to lead an effective team below them? Just one thing or two things that are really meaningful to you?
Well, I do think, I mean, the beauty of the sales world is that it's like the scoreboard's there constantly. So you kind of, it's a performance driven world. So it is, there's such a strong quantitative aspect with it. And some people are comfortable with that and others aren't. So I do think, and Bill Wagner in his time at LogMeIn really instilled this in me, is like, look, if you're going to be in a leadership position, you'll be held accountable for the performance of your team. And that means like across every individual, the overall performance of your team is a direct reflection of you as a leader. That is my message to my teams that I work with. And it's not meant to scare or intimidate. It's meant to really bring to the surface how you're actually going to be judged in the seat. And again, I think in sales and customer success, in a large part in marketing, when you think of like, digital marketing and demand generation, pipeline generation, there's a real score that can be kept there. And so understanding that if you hold yourself accountable to that, if you truly feel ownership of the number and responsibility for the number, and understand that your ability to continue to take on more responsibility, either at your current company or a future role, is only, like, you're only going to be given that if you earn it, and you earn it by making sure that you're doing the work to continue to increase the overall performance of your team, whether that's a big team, if you're a CRO or a CMO or chief customer officer, or it's a small team, then you're an individual, you're a frontline manager who has 6 salespeople on your team. Like, you're your performance is that group of six. And so if you have performance management issues or challenges with them kind of doing enough inputs to yield the output that you need, it's your responsibility to make the changes and kind of drive the changes. And I think over time, as I've built teams and I hire people that have that mindset of, yes, this is me, this is my responsibility, versus it's somebody else's fault, then you can build a really strong kind of well-oiled and efficient organization when you have that mentality all the way through.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks.
Easier said than done, because it takes time. And people are people. Like, they're individual humans who come from very different backgrounds and have different sets of values and characteristics that they're that they associate leadership with. And so you have to make sure that you sort of build it out and be very clear. What I've had to work on is my communication can sometimes either come across as very direct, or I've had situations where I assume too much. I assume that my leaders knew enough about how to structure a sales organization. And they're like, why are you making these changes? And I was like, oh, I can't believe I skipped that step of actually going deep and talking to them about it. This happened when I was at Drift. So, you know, it's a constant, you're constantly in motion of growing and working on it and collecting feedback so that you can continue to improve. But ultimately underneath that, it's accountability and making sure that your team and the individual teams and the people on the teams feel like, yeah, I'm responsible for this job at this company, and they're relying on me to do it at the best of my ability.
That's amazing, Josh. Thank you. I think that, you know, that your answer around accountability to me really speaks to the difference between holding people accountable, which I really hate that language around, right? And actually inspiring ownership and accountability. And so I think that's just, you know, as Nikki said, like earlier, just a great example of the messiness of leadership. And so we so appreciate you sharing a piece of your journey with us. As we wrap up, you know, you just talked a little bit about some of the things that you've worked on. If we go back to that concept of just, you know, that one thing, right, that you sort of are coaching your team members on or coaching your lacrosse players on, just really quickly as a way of wrapping up, what's the one thing you're continuing to work on as you continue to evolve as a leader?
Yeah, I think the one thing that in my mind is never done is communication. And it's because, so I'm starting a new role with a new company. It's a new group of people who some of I've worked with before, but most I have not. And the way people communicate it's a very one-to-one thing. I could say something to the three of you, I could say something out loud, and you will process it slightly differently from one another. And so for me, it's having that constant awareness. So if I'm talking in front of my sales team of 100 people and I deliver a message, I have to be conscious of the fact that that message may be received differently. And if I didn't do a good enough job of communicating the core intent of the message, then I've got to figure out another way to get that through. That part around communication, and also, like, I have had feedback sometimes when I'm in like deep thought and really thinking, I'm perceived as unapproachable, like, because it's like I'm so into what I'm trying to do. And so trying to sort of open that up to make sure that, because I remember as when I was 22 and 23 in my first sales job, walking into the VP of sales office was super intimidating. Because you feel like you're going to ask a stupid question, or that they don't have time to be able to deal with you. And so I try to be constantly aware of that and break that down as best I can. But that will always be a work in progress for me forever.
Awesome. Yeah, that's what we share so often with our coaching clients. It's often zeroing in on those one or two things and then seeing that they just keep coming up and they just keep coming up. And that is not to be defeatist, but it is just to recognize our patterns and again those one or two things that we're all working on. So thank you for sharing yours with us, and thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's been such a joy and a privilege to have you join us in conversation today.
I love talking about it. Leadership is hard, and it's a constant, it is constantly in motion. So I appreciate it. It was fun.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you for your insights. Thank you.